We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week we're talking about The Godfather. Part two.
Part two. This is not a, it's not a dream. This is a new episode.
New episode.
Yeah. 2 years later from, well, 2 years.
No, it's just been a week.
No, that's right. This movie released 2 years after the movie that we did last week. Yeah. So we're putting our episodes out way quicker than Francis Ford Coppola did. So suck that.
Yeah. Suck an egg, Francis Ford Coppola.
R.I.P. Yeah.
Is he dead?
I don't know. Did we talk about that last time? Hold on. Let me check. You're going to get there before me. I can feel it.
No, he's alive.
He's alive.
Still making movies too.
Awesome. So yeah, part two of our conversation of The Godfather.
That's right.
But before we get into that, do we have a mail call?
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get into this movie, let's talk about an email we received today.
Well, not today as in you're listening. Today as in we're recording, just so the listener is not confused.
That's right. We received it today, the day that we're recording this, that you will eventually listen to.
Our not today, today. Not your today.
Your to, yeah, yeah, our today.
Yeah.
Just, my left.
Yeah. Thank you. Not to get you.
All right. Subject line. Let's talk about guns, Jeff. Jeff, I love you, and you're wrong. Well, before we really get into this, so I want to say that the contents of this email are things that I largely agree with, but I disagree with the tone.
Okay.
I think that they could be put in a gentler way.
I read this ahead of time. I'll get into my thoughts after you read the email.
Yeah, I felt like this was an email that you needed to be able to have some time to respond, to think about before you responded to.
Pray about, yeah.
We're going to go through, he's got 5 points, and we're going to go through each one. And I'm going to talk about why I think he's right and how I'd word it differently and defend your honor.
I did not put Nelson up to this, by the way.
He didn't. Yeah. This is just the person I am.
All right, let's have it.
1. Stop changing the subject. Every time Nelson corners you, you either A, change the subject, or B, use amphiboly or ambiguity to use a phrase or word differently than it was intended. This is a dishonest way to argue. Jeff, are you currently looking up amphiboly? Because if you are, you're going to find out that it's a mineral deposit, and I don't think it's the word that was intended here.
I looked it up earlier, and it made me question my kidneys.
This is going to start to sound redundant as we go through the five, but for this first one, I don't think it's necessarily fair to blame Jeff on this. When I'm editing, sometimes significant sections get edited out, and I try not to edit in such a way that anybody's point gets undermined or anybody like ends up doing red herrings or changing the conversation suddenly, but sometimes it can feel that way. It might be my responsibility there that it felt like Jeff was changing the subject. Jeff is more uncomfortable with confrontation than I am.
I was going to get into that in a second. Yep.
And so if either of us feel like we're getting too frustrated, or if we feel like we're taking out our frustration on each other, we both try to change the tone and direction of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
With the episode that this is in reference to, that's our Dr. Strangelove episode.
Yes.
I was very frustrated, and I had trouble getting back to the episode.
Yeah, neither of us were prepared to talk about that subject.
Right.
It came up very naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Or, it just came up.
Wasn't directed.
Right.
Jeff, is there anything you wanted to say about that point, about stop changing the subject?
Only that, like, first of all, like, I appreciate this email. So, like, we are kind of breaking down what we're talking about, and we're
we love positive feedback, and we need negative feedback.
Yeah, no, so, like, I am very grateful for this email. And yes, I know that I was on the opposite side of Nelson, as every day we record.
Yeah.
But like,
because if we sat next to each other looking at the wall, that'd be weird.
Yeah. No. And we tried that. That was rough. So no, I just overall, I'm not great at debating things.
Mm.
And as you've probably heard in many, if not all of the previous episodes, like I'm not as nerdy or comprehensively knowledgeable about a lot of the things we talk about.
You flatter me.
Oh, I mean, I try. So there are a lot of times where a lot of my basis is coming out of childhood or
my
upbringing, gut instinct, emotion. And I even said that in the episode. I did acknowledge that, like, I don't have an answer. I know it's idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I tried to keep the tone because I never disagreed with you, Nelson. I just didn't want to agree with you because it meant a type of society that I didn't think was best. But I didn't have anything to back that up as far as, like, well, what's the alternative? I don't have an answer.
Right.
I just know in my life that feels wrong, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
But I just want to clarify. I'll give my notes now. And then as you go into this, like, cause it is pretty much encompasses everything that this listener emailed. Like, I'm not great at debating. And this is probably the most heated we've gotten in an episode.
Right.
We're still friends. And
well,
and I just, I'm not,
we're work associates.
It's, we had to get a third party in. But like, I'm not great at debating. I'm not great at defending apologetics. Like I'm not a great defending myself. Like I just, normally it's just like, I avoid confrontation. Normally I avoid conflict. I run and hide when things get tough and difficult. That's just my personality. Like I get uncomfortable. And so like, that's probably could have been a lot of my subject changing too. Cause there may have been times where I'm like, I'm correlating something you said in my head. It made sense. And I didn't, and I may have said it in a way where it came out or came across that was like, wait, what? Left turn. And I don't listen to the episodes. And I know we've talked about this prior, like maybe I should, but like, I didn't listen to our conversation again, but I know there was probably times where I was like, well, if you're saying this, this is what you mean. I was making assumptions, and that's in the email too. You'll read, he brings that up and stuff. So I don't disagree with the list, with the email. I'm not good at defending
opinions and ideas, opinions,
especially when they're hot.
Mm.
Like, and this was a hot subject, maybe the hottest topic we've talked about so far,
mm-hmm.
at least for us, you and I personally, because we're both passionate about the value of humanity. We're both passionate about seeing people thrive. I was thinking more idealistically. I was thinking more like, well, in a perfect world, in a perfect system, this wouldn't happen this way. It's like, so my mind,
you are right. And that's right. That you're correct.
Right. And then, so my mind's like, and so my mind just keeps going to the way of like, well, let's act as if it is a perfect world,
mm-hmm.
build it. They will come type of mentality. Whereas yours, like, and the email, which you'll get to, was like, well, that's not the world we live in. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
So like,
and you said yourself, and I didn't catch it during the conversation, but I heard it in the edit. You said more than once, my disagreement is with reality, or
it's idealistic of me to say, like, you are acknowledging it. And I don't think I gave that enough credit during the conversation because I wasn't hearing it.
Yeah.
But your point was basically like, well, that's not the world I want to live in, but it's the world that we live in.
Yeah. The way I try to live life is live life the way it shouldn't be, not the way it is be.
Start with the man in the mirror.
That's right. So Michael
Corleone.
Yes. Continue with the email.
I want to say one other thing there.
Oh my goodness.
That the progressive movement of politics
is no longer a religious one. It's kind of like a pagan religion now, but like it started with Christian values.
Yeah.
It was a post-millennial movement, which is, you know, it's abandoned that post-millennialism because they don't believe in, they're not Christians for the most part, or at least not practicing Christians for the most part. But it is an idea that the sinful fallen world can be fixed by voting for the right legislators and by voting for the right legislation. And I can no longer share that opinion after having looked at history long enough. It's not going to work.
And that's really where the split comes down for you and I on what do we do about guns, right?
Yeah.
I would rather people not use weapons against each other, but we can't put the toothpaste back in the tube of machine guns and atomic weapons.
Mm.
And so I think that the best option is to totally decentralize and democratize that. Mm. Let everybody have access to it. And I agree that, is that the world I would like to live in? No, but I think that that's the best solution to the world we do live in.
Mm.
But continuing on with this email, 2, stop arguing from ignorance. I don't know or I don't understand is not a positive case. I dislike a thing or do not know a thing or do not understand a thing. And then concluding that that thing should be regulated or prohibited is always wrong. This is a dishonest way to argue. This is also an almost guaranteed way to reach a false conclusion. I think it's only dishonest if the person making the arguments knows that it's wrong.
It could be an ignorant way to argue, but that doesn't make it dishonest.
I will plead the fifth right now. I am ignorant.
If you were pleading the fifth, it would be saying nothing.
Oh.
Taking the right not to incriminate yourself.
Objection, Your Honor. I will say
sustained.
I will say I would consider myself in the ignorant party when it comes to these things. However, it is a subject not from education background, but just because of personal lifestyle choices and stuff that, you know, my wife is a school teacher. Like, it does come from an emotional place, not an academic place.
Sure.
So I don't know all the rules about the regulations of guns. I don't know the history of gun regulation.
Yeah.
I don't know other countries' regulations on guns. Mm-hmm. So I am ignorant when it comes to the global gun
conversation.
I was hoping to make that clear in the conversation, like, mm-hmm. because I have an opinion. That doesn't mean sure. it's right. But having an opinion is different than claiming to be knowledgeable. And I never claim to be knowledgeable sure. about it. I just claim to be like, I'm emotional about it.
Yeah.
I'm passionate about what I would like for it to be.
Right.
And because of that, that's why what you're saying felt wrong, right. even though I couldn't disagree with the plan you were putting in place. Because the plan you put in place is the exact same plan I agree with when it comes to drugs.
Right.
It's like, I know
or that, literally any other
that,
civil
that
right.
plan makes that plan makes sense in my head, but when it comes to guns, for some reason I can't get myself to say do it. I can't Palpatine the thing.
Yeah.
Like, for me, it's like, that seems wrong. And I don't have an answer for that. I am ignorant to defend it, but that doesn't mean I don't feel that way.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, and it's not a view I've always had on guns.
That's certainly something that's evolved and I evolved through that as a result of.
Like, I used to take the constitutionalist approach and I'm like, well, the Second Amendment says, and now I'm kind of like, well, the Constitution and its amendments is kind of lousy and a piece of paper is not really compelling enough to get anybody.
The Constitution, which I think you said this, the fact that the Constitution needed amended, mean it wasn't perfect in the first place.
Right,
like,
right.
It's like,
exactly.
Yeah, it's,
and so I come to the position now of the Second Amendment affirms and recognizes rights that we have regardless of what the Constitution says, right? So if the Constitution and its amendments didn't exist, the universal truth that you have the right to defend yourself doesn't evaporate with it. 3, putting words into other people's mouths is lying. To say, quote, so what you're saying is, and then the opposite of what that person said, taken to the furthest extreme, is not only deceitful and dishonest, it's despicable. I specifically want to defend you on this one because this happens two different ways. It does happen in the one way of trying to get a sound clip and twisting somebody's words, which is what he's insinuating you're doing here. But that's not what you were doing. You were quite literally trying to understand my position by taking it to its furthest extremes.
Correct.
And here's the thing, and I acknowledge this in the edit, all of the things you said, so what you're saying is blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that is what I'm saying, right? All the things you said, you took it to extreme degrees. And those, there might be a couple of exceptions if I went back and listened to it. But most of the time I was like, yeah, that's what I'm saying, Jeff. It's an uncomfortable truth, yeah. But that is what I'm saying. So I really want to defend you on that because I don't think you were taking the words out of my mouth and misinterpreting me.
I know I did say the phrase, so what you're saying is.
Yeah.
I know I did say that.
Because you're trying to understand and clarify.
Right. So, and I do, yeah, I do kind of like, even though I hate confrontation, I love living in that devil's advocate area of just going, well, what would you do if you did this? Well,
yeah.
I hope I did it in a manner to where I was like, I was trying to push you in a way to where I could get a clear answer of what you were trying to explain.
Yeah.
Not a way of entrapment.
Yeah.
I do that off the air, and not on the air.
Here's the thing too, with the pushing to the extreme, you're trying to see if there's any logical inconsistencies I've got.
Like, so for example, when people say my body, my choice, but then they seem to draw the line at, should you be required by law to take untested and unproven experimental medicine? And they say, yeah, you should. Well, then they don't really believe my body, my choice. So it's like, how much do you actually believe what you're saying?
Right.
And I was making the argument that all weapons should be available. And you're like, so what you're saying is people should be able to have nukes? And yeah, that is what I'm saying. Do I want a nuke? Nope. I have no interest in owning a nuke. But you can't put the nuclear toothpaste back in the tube, it's been invented.
They're called silos.
You can't uninvent the bomb, right? Yeah.
You got
silos. Good one.
Thank you.
I liked it. I was just in the middle of a...
No, it was good. It was good.
Good joke. I hope you laughed at home.
Yeah.
Four, comparing any possible outcome to, quote, a perfect world, end quote, is useless and only a distraction. It is a red herring. It serves only to distract the other and sidetrack the conversation. We do not have a perfect world. We have this world. We have only the now. After we have entered the new creation, we can compare where and when we came from to the perfect world. I don't agree with him here. I think it's perfectly fine to say in a perfect world X, especially if you're following that up with but,
right,
which we were.
Yeah.
And I think you were as well.
Yeah.
So I would agree with this if that's what had been done, but I don't think that's a fair accusation of what was going on your side of the conversation. And then the last one here, if the facts lead to a conclusion you dislike, even actively dislike, you don't get to reject the facts. You do not even get to just reject the arguments. You also are not committed to accepting the conclusions. You can say, I dislike that conclusion, but you make a strong case. I need to think about that. Then you need to honestly think about that. And here, again, I really got to go to the bat with Jeff, for Jeff. He does this every single time. This was a harder one for him.
Not having listened to the episode, I wonder if there's a specific thing he's referencing that where I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and if I did, I apologize.
It's certainly true. You know, almost all the time you're like, yeah, I really can't argue with that. And my dad's teased you, Jeff, you need to push back on Nelson more, yeah, right?
Just in that, whether we're talking about flavors of pop,
yeah,
or we're talking about life and death, I'm uncomfortable with confrontation.
Sure.
Even you and me, like before, years ago, before this podcast, you and I were talking about Star Wars.
Yeah.
I think it was right after one of these sequel trilogy movies came out. You and I were talking and you had some strong opinions about it. And I immediately, just impulsively, just backed off. I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm sorry you disappointed me. Like I didn't, even though I had my reasons for defending the reason, yeah, I liked it, I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I just didn't want to talk to you anymore about it because, like, I'm not out to change other people's minds.
Right.
I'm just out to be a part of a discussion. And I was uncomfortable just because I was like, oh, we're on two polar opposite sides of this. I didn't know how to defend myself. I was like, I just enjoyed it. I was just entertained.
Yeah. And I think that's,
yeah.
And we've talked about this since. We both agree. Yeah, I liked it because I liked it is fine. Now, I, Jeff, this is something you've come a long way on.
Oh, thank you.
And
hair growth.
And despite the retreating hairline, you've had some growth.
I didn't say where.
All on your elbows. Got real hairy elbows.
Thank you for noticing.
Yeah, so I don't think that this concept of rejecting the facts, rejecting the arguments is necessarily true of you. I think it's fair to say that there are times where if you're uncomfortable with the discussion, you might be evasive and change the subject. And I think everybody does that. Everybody's got the right to do that.
Mm-hmm. I know there was multiple times where I did say, I don't disagree with you, I just don't want to agree with you.
Sure.
Or something along those lines.
Yeah, like, yeah, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of...
I had no defending my argument,
same thing
but
happens,
that doesn't mean I like your argument.
The same thing happens when I talk about my solution to the issues in the way policing is managed currently. People will be like, you know what, Nelson? You're right. There are all those problems. I can't come to your position, though. I'm not comfortable with where your position is. There's got to be other ways to resolve this. And I understand why people feel that way. I personally think that my arguments are very convincing. And these are arguments that I've gleaned from people much smarter than myself. As far as rejecting the facts, I don't think that's fair because you and I weren't looking at facts.
Right.
We might have referenced outside sources and stuff, but neither of us sourced our facts. These are, you know,
off the cuff.
Yep. So I don't think that's entirely fair. I appreciate the spirit, but not the tone,
right,
in which this email was written.
And please continue those. Like, for me, this journey, you and I are in different places when we started this podcast and almost a year into this.
Yeah, we used to record at my house. Now we record,
yeah,
at yours.
And because of that, like, I feel like I have grown a lot in the way that I view things and I've learned how to communicate better. I haven't perfected it, but like, I'm a work in progress. So, like, I appreciate this criticism, even if it is hard for me to hear, which this one wasn't because I didn't necessarily disagree with them. I was just like, yeah, I know. Like, but yeah, so no, I am very grateful for this email and it's something that I will think about afterwards and I will hopefully, you know, it will help me communicate better and be better. I'm doing a podcast. I should be able to communicate my thoughts clearly and clearly to some listeners they did not come across clearly and I need to work on that better. So I appreciate that.
And then
please stop listening.
I'm kidding. There was a few people that texted me to say that
the way you handled the gun discussion had them yelling at their car stereos and pulling out their hair.
Is it just because I'm choosing the side of a pacifist?
You're not choosing the side of a pacifist. I'm also a pacifist. We're both
right, but like, I guess I don't understand like what's so counter.
They felt
intuitive to the people that like they I didn't felt say a lot offensive. Like, I was just like,
no,
I don't want people to be armed in the streets when my wife and child go grocery shopping. Sure. Like that was the only thing I stated. I stated clearly, I'm not anti-gun. I have many friends that own guns and I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But I am for doing it, whatever the legal way is, in the way that I know that if someone has a gun, I can assume that it's done the right way and they've done all the background checks and their mental health is checked. Like just because of the world we live in. That's my one request is that if someone's going to have a gun legally, let's not make it so any Tom, Dick and Harry can do it. Which again, I know you disagree with. Are you okay with deeper background checks? Or like, are you okay with that deeper tests before people can get guns legally? Or like, or am I way off the mark with our listeners? What category would I be put in with the way I see this? There's probably a name for it.
What most people would conclude is that you are for quote unquote common sense gun reform. And okay. Then
that sounds
that
nice.
Sit, yeah. Well, that's the term that people that advocate for it use. And then the people that would disagree with you would argue there is nothing common sense about gun reform unless your reform is the abolition of gun laws.
Now, and obviously, like, I'm not. I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but like, I'm not anti-gun, but I am gun shy. I've not been around them. It's like, but I don't think that has a dealing with my opinion though, because like, I'm very willing to go to a shooting range if someone invites me.
Yeah.
It's just not something I would pursue on my own. So like, so I'm very much willing to go shoot guns. Like, I don't think I'm gun shy or like scared of guns. I'm ignorant of guns. So I don't know if that's also part of it, but like, but I feel like because I'm ignorant, I feel like I'm not the only one.
Oh, definitely not.
So like, I feel like maybe there could be a lot more people that if we educate more people on it, and I think we talked about this in the episode, like schools used to have shooting classes in school. Like
riflery.
Yeah. I'm not opposed to that. That's just a scary concept knowing that now all we hear about is when there's guns in
I'm
school.
Opposed
it's
to
morbidly.
It. I'm opposed to it only because I'm opposed to schools.
That's a whole different episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to end school shootings overnight, abolish schools. Problem solved. No more school shootings.
Not everyone's fit to be a teacher, Nelson. Even spiritually, everyone's fit to be.
I think that most teachers aren't fit to be teachers, Jeff.
I would agree with that.
Which brings me back to abolish schools.
But that doesn't mean that all schools.
So here's why I think people felt like they were pulling out their hair. Is a lot of the things that you were saying are talking points that I've heard a dozen times from people anywhere from uncomfortable with guns like yourself to passionately opposed to them. And anybody that is familiar with the conversation from the other side of the argument, and like I clarified, I'm not a gun guy. I don't know gun.
What about those two pythons under your sweater there?
Ooh. Sun's out, guns out.
I don't know a lot about weaponry. I'm pretty ignorant. My position on guns is purely a deductive reasoning one. I'm a pacifist. And so how people choose to defend themselves is their business.
As long as they're not forcing me to arm myself, I'm comfortable. And as long as nobody's forcing them to disarm, I'm comfortable. That's where I land on the gun debate. I don't know gun stuff. I just know rights. And
trigger warning.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that.
Trigger warning. Let's talk about guns.
Yeah.
So I think the reason people felt like they were pulling out their hair is because so often, Jeff, you're willing to discuss and entertain ideas and hear points counter to your opinion on a variety of things. And on this one, for, as you said, emotional reasons, you had a real hard time giving ground. And I respect that. I think that if people have an opinion on something that they're passionate about, it's worthwhile to dig in, right? Double down. But know why you believe the thing that you believe and be able to defend it. Like, there are people that passionately disagree with me and they do it from like a well-read position. And I find that very respectable. I think what has people pull out their hair is when they feel that the person who's passionately disagreeing isn't informed on the discussion. And as you and I both said, we're not gun guys.
Yeah.
Right? This is purely a philosophical conversation about self-defense.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the episode.
Yeah. tune in next week where we talk about
Godfather Sasquatch. Part 7. Oh, that one.
Sasquatch Part 7.
Sasquatch.
Godfather Part Sasquatch.
Beef jerky.
Ooh. The God Squatch? I'd watch that movie.
The God Squatch.
Crypto crime. He's stealing Bitcoin.
His name's got to be Henderson. That's all I ask.
All right.
Anyways.
Let's talk about why we came here tonight.
Yes. Oh, man. Women's rights. No. Godfather Part
2. The 19th Amendment was a mistake.
Godfather Part 2, 1974. This movie runs at approximately 3 hours and 22 minutes. Directed by the Francis Ford Coppola.
That's right.
Rated R. This is the second of three movies. This the third one coming out in 1990.
Which is not on the top 250.
Is not on the top 250.
Will not be covered on this show.
Nope.
So, despite everybody's saying, yeah, hey.
All the mass hysteria crowds that are outside my house right now. They're requesting us to do it.
after Godfather Part 1, which hasn't released yet.
It's not aired yet, yeah. Notable cast. Al Pacino was in the original. Mm-hmm. Robert De Niro, who was not in the original.
He's not in the first one. He is in the second one. He's playing Young Vito.
Robert Duvall, who was in the second one.
That's right.
The first one. And Diane Keaton, who was also in the first
one. That's
right. Those are the four names that were predominant.
The big names.
Yeah. Abe Vigoda was not in this one. Marlon Brando was not in this one. Mm-mm. He was actually supposed to be in this one.
Yeah.
They were supposed to shoot a scene with him in it.
Pretty sure I know what the scene is because you hear him off camera. Yeah. Actually, no, you hear people talking to him off camera. He's not even in this.
But it was one day and there was a conflict of interest of some sort.
Conflicts of interest.
He didn't show to his one day of filming, so they changed the scene, filmed it differently the day later.
He was also famously difficult to work with. I believe in the first one, he refused to wear pants in a bunch of scenes, which is why he's like behind a desk so often, is because he just wouldn't put on pants. Man. He was a nut, man. He was an absolute lunatic and very difficult to work with.
I'm going to take my pants off in honor of Marlon Brando.
I'm going to put my pants back on.
9.0 on the IMDb out of 10. It currently stands number 4 on the IMDb Top 250.
That's right.
Today as we're recording this episode. Rotten Tomatoes, it stands at 96% tomato meter,
mm-hmm,
and 97 audience.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any of the IMDb history track record?
It debuted at 70 and fell to 83 within a year. It jumped to 17 in September 1998. And slowly climbed to third by 2002.
Third?
It's been third or fourth since. It kind of bounces back between those two.
Okay. You got a budget on this guy.
Yeah. $13 million to make in 1984.
74. Well, it released in 74, so it was probably made in 73.
Yeah.
But
$13 million, 520% inflation since then, so about $80
million. Roughly double the budget.
The first movie.
Filming in multiple locations, Miami, New York,
yeah.
Nevada, Italy.
Did they do on scene filming?
Maybe some. The Miami stuff was all inside or in closed locations, and that could have maybe not been Miami. But and the city streets could have been a studio as well, too. But some of the mansions and stuff,
mm-hmm,
in that lake,
Tahoe.
Lake Tahoe. That was a different lake.
Yeah.
And then Italy, I believe. That some of those scenes were Italy. Yeah.
But yeah. So Godfather Part 2 is still based on the book The Godfather. The sequel to The Godfather, the book, The Sicilian, didn't come out for another 10 years. In the last few days, I listened to the book The Godfather.
Oh.
I
noticed your Italian accent when you came in here.
Yeah. And I demanded a calzone. Oof. And then slapped your wife in the true Sicilian way. I've been learning a lot from this book.
Kiss, kiss.
Yeah. So in The Godfather Part 2, all of the flashback scenes to the young Vito, that's all from the book. Everything that happens chronologically after
modern day.
Yeah. That was created for the movie. But it was created by the author. I had his name here.
Mario Puzo. Yeah. He wrote the book, The Godfather, that became the three movies.
So wait, you even know stuff now that's probably going to be in the third one.
No, because the third one, I don't know.
Not spoiling. I haven't watched the third one yet.
So I haven't either.
So you don't.
We're not going to cover on this show anyway, but right, I haven't
seen it. I do plan on watching it just to finish the trilogy.
Yeah.
Was there anything in the book that didn't come up in the first two movies? Like, was there a lot more?
Plenty.
Okay.
Plenty.
So there was a lot
more material. Yeah, and I really enjoyed The Godfather. Spoiler, I thought Godfather Part 2 was fine.
I also thought the first one was better than the second one.
Yeah, like significantly.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. like, yeah. Godfather is in my top 250. Godfather Part 2, probably not.
The book, it's about 25 to 33% smut.
Oh, really? Graphic or just...
So, sex scenes typically do not add to a story.
Right.
But in this, where it's a story about family and vice and humanity, I think it really adds a lot. Now,
Mario Puzo is very liberal in his description,
and I think that that was unnecessary. That for me, it didn't add anything to
translate to the movie, because like these movies are oddly,
yes,
like not oddly, but like very minimally sexually,
yeah,
explicit.
Yeah, and that's that really surprised me in the book that there's so much of that.
It creates a lot of additional flavor. There's a lot of additional
politicking and drama in the book. I liked the book a lot more.
Even in the first movie?
Than the movie, yeah. Wow. A lot more. I strongly recommend
Would you put this in your top 250 books? That's our next podcast, by the way.
Yeah, it's right up there with Redfish, Bluefish. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love for that to be a movie.
Something we didn't talk about with Godfather, but a question that it's kind of our unofficial wrap-up question is, would you like to see this redone? I don't think I'd like to see the Godfather movie part one or part two redone.
Agreed.
However, if they took the book and made it like a shot-for-shot
miniseries or something,
like TV series, I think it would be phenomenal.
Okay. Follow the book as close to a T as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Would it be drastically different?
Like
would it have a different tone? Would it watch differently than the movies, or would you still go, yeah, I've been here before?
I think so.
Okay. Well,
there were things that I was expecting going into The Godfather that never happened. Things that would kind of support my biases.
Mm-hmm.
Assumptions that I had about the kind of person that The Godfather is. The book does a really good job of painting more of who these people are, their backstories, why they think the way that they do. And it confirmed a lot of my suspicions and biases in really interesting ways. I think that a TV series has more room to explore that and explain that than the movie does. There's a lot that has to get cut to make it into, even as long as it was, a 3-hour movie. A lot ends up getting cut. Like, for example, Godfather Part 2, half the movie is Vito Corleone's life before the first movie.
And that's all from the book.
And that's all from the book. Yeah. The book, the novel, is 8 books.
But you're still talking about just the first one.
The first book is 8 books. So it was like book, yeah. So,
oh, you read all 8.
No. It's a single novel.
Okay.
So sometimes books will be like part one, and then it'll have several.
The first book is 8 books.
That's right. Sometimes when you look into a book, like it'll be like part one, and then it's got a bunch of chapters. Part two, a bunch of chapters.
Yeah.
Stylistically, Mario Puzo writes these as book one, bunch of chapters, book two, a bunch of chapters. It's 8 books, 35 total chapters.
Okay.
But anyway, phenomenal book. Strongly recommend it. Much, much better than either of the movies.
Now, this book you read that had 8 books within the one book, mm-hmm. are there more books outside? Like, is there another?
Yeah. So 10 years after Godfather Part 2, Mario Puzo published
The Sicilian.
The Sicilian, which is the sequel.
How many books are in that book? This gets real confusing.
I don't know. I haven't read it. Book math. We touched on this a little bit last episode.
We did.
Godfather, The Sicilian, and then...
Which takes place between, because remember I told you, The Godfather is 8 books. The Sicilian takes place between 6th and 7th books of The Godfather. So if you really wanted to do, like...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
The Sicilian, 7, 8.
Yeah, well, and then here's the weird thing, too. Yeah, I think like it's like chapter 4, book 4 or 5 was Vito Corleone's youth. It's like you have all this stuff, and then it jumps back to his youth, right? And then you like read all this stuff that happened, and then it jumps back to, well, here's what was happening to Michael and Sicily during that time. Some authors will like bounce around locations even within a chapter. Mario Puzo doesn't. He's like, here's a book, and that book is basically like in a movie would be a chapter.
Got you.
I
got you.
They don't really do that anymore. They do scenes now, but like back with DVDs, you'd have chapters, and it's like here's like 15 minutes of the movie all at once.
Okay.
I strongly recommend it. I really, really liked it. And then The Family, I think, was part of that
series. The Family.
La Familia.
Yeah, I recommend it. Check it out.
In 2020, they readapted Godfather Part 3, The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone.
So spoilers.
Wonder if he dies. Well, we'll never know. Not on this podcast.
Schrodinger's death.
So we need to put Michael Corleone in a box. Mm-hmm. All right.
And we'll never know if he dies until we open the box. I guess Schrodinger's cat was also, we don't know if it dies. So it wouldn't be Schrodinger's death. It'd be Schrodinger's Michael Corleone.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Overall, yeah. you enjoyed this movie though. Like it was.
Nah, it's fine.
Okay.
Like I probably won't watch this again for a while.
I found myself less invested in Michael than I was in Vito.
Yeah.
But in that same breath, then watching this part two, anytime there was a flashback, I was way invested in the flashbacks. But you go to present time, I'm just like, eh. I don't really care about the casinos. There's a lot of good lines in it though. A lot of good moments. And one line specifically, which I can save for later. But one line specifically that it's a great line, and that now I know where that movie comes, that the line comes from, which I'm surprised I didn't pick up on last week.
Mm.
This isn't really a bias, so we can talk about this now. But Michael Corleone is with Fredo, and he goes, "I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart." I've heard that before. New Girl referenced Fredo kissing in New Girl.
You broke my heart.
I never knew what Fredo kissing was until watching this movie. But that kiss was very passionate, more passionate than I've ever kissed any of my brothers. But yeah, so that line, I was like, oh yeah, cool. I know that one.
Mm-hmm.
They never word for word said the line that Vito said. Like that iconic line from the first movie didn't come back verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
There is a soundbite of young Vito saying it, but he says it a little differently. And then Michael has his own variation of manipulating. But that was Vito's tagline. So
yeah. I want to keep it to what's in the movie, but I said there's stuff in the books that confirm some of my biases. So basically, the reason Vito Corleone is the way that he is because in Sicily, the government was so corrupt and it forced all these people to fled, but it was so corrupt that one of the worst insults you could give somebody is to call them a policeman. That's what the book says.
Because going like not to the not to the person of a police, but like the idea of policing someone.
Yeah.
Like, so then they took it as like, well, you're policing me, so you're a policeman.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
And it's like, all our government's corrupt. We hate them. It's like, they were like ACAP, basically. All cops are...
In this movie, we saw part of his flashbacks. This was in the book. We see that there's the guy creating all that trouble, and he's like a mob guy, and Vito kills him. The movie, I think, doesn't explain it as well as the book does, which is Vito realizes from watching this guy doesn't have men. This guy doesn't have people in his pocket. This guy doesn't have political power.
Three men tried to kill him. One of them he killed, and the other two he let off in a deal. And no mob boss would ever allow that. So he realizes this guy isn't actually protected. We're going to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes him out, and his two buddies, Clemenza and... I can't think of it. They were like, well, hey, now nobody's collecting on those rackets. Maybe we go start collecting. And Vito's like, if that's what you guys want to do, go ahead. I'm going to have no business in that.
He ended a vendetta.
Yeah. Then his wife, as we see in the movie, says, hey, I need you to talk to so-and-so. She's having a hard time. And so he goes and he talks to the landlord. And he's like, hey,
I need you to help this lady out.
And word gets around town that, because everybody in the neighborhood, even though Vito's not admitted to anything, everybody in the neighborhood knows that he did it. And everybody's grateful that he did it. And the way he becomes crime boss is people come to him and say, hey, I need help with this. I know that you're a man of means. You're respectable. People love you.
He gets stuff done.
Can you help me out? And it was just a like friends looking out for friends thing. I'm looking after the people in my neighborhood. Eventually, he gets on the payroll of all the groceries, but not because he's running a protection racket.
Which we see that symbolically, not symbolically, but we see that played out when he comes to New York. Like we see a guy that does protection racketeering.
That's the guy he kills.
Okay. He kills. Okay. You're talking about that. I thought you were talking about the guy that killed his mom.
No.
Okay.
No, after he's coming to America.
Because he kills two people.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm
talking, I was tracking with you, but I was thinking it was the Italian guy from Italy.
Unless I missed it, that the guy in Italy that he kills that killed his mother and his father, that's not in the book. Unless I missed it. I don't think I did. Not in the book. I'm talking about the large guy in the white suit.
Okay, I got you. In New York.
So, yeah, he's running a protection racket. A protection racket is...
You go to stores, you make a threat of violence, and then say, but I, for a small fee, I can protect you from that violence. What tends to happen with protection rackets is if another gang is going to muscle in on that territory, they start knocking up the stores and say, look, so-and-so can't actually protect you, but we can.
And usually they'll have like a third party knock up the store or something like that. But in this...
Oh, that's the Seth Rogen movie, Knocked Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which was not on the
him
top
250. Him and Katherine Heigl start robbing grocery stores.
Knocked Up.
Anyway, so in the book, they come to him. Hey, we got hoodlums in our stores. Is there anything you can do about that? We know you're a persuasive guy. And he takes care of him. He's like, yep, I'll make sure that nobody's bothering your store. And then the grocers, out of their own thankfulness to their friend, Don Vito Corleone, say, hey, here's some lovely fruit for you. In one scene in the book, he goes to a grocery store, doesn't touch any of the fruit. You pick it up, you handle it yourself. He just points at the things that he wants, and the guy bags up for him. He points at some apples. The grocer picks up this apple, turns it over to expose, actually, this one's rotten. You don't want this one. So Vito builds his empire through exclusively voluntary means. He only uses force on people using force. Anybody else, it's like, hey, I'm doing this for you, and someday I might need you to do something for me. And I'll never ask you to do anything that I don't think that you'd be willing to do.
Do you think that example you talked about, people going to grocery stores, and do you think that still happens today? Does it look different? Or like, or do you still think, not that I'm pro it, but like, do you still think that's something that you could do, like if you went down to the mini mart here and went, you know, if you pulled it, like that can't happen anymore, can it? Like that type, like so
protection rackets?
Yeah. Like
protection rackets still happen.
Okay.
More in cities.
Okay. Stuff like, okay.
Yeah.
And then, so there are still crime bosses that use the exact same tactic, even though like security cameras and all that stuff, like it's probably a lot more riskier.
It's different today, but it still exists. Okay. But yeah, he was providing service for free. And people were out of their own thankfulness. And then what the movie doesn't do is explain why he's the Godfather. And it seems obvious once it covers it in the book, but the Godfather was not his title. That was his nickname. His title was Don Corleone. His nickname was the Godfather because everybody in this community, super, super Catholic, and all of them, out of their appreciation for what he was doing for the community, we're asking him to be the godfather of their children. And so here we are a generation later. All of the adults in the community are his godchildren. He is their godfather. And when it explains it, I'm like, oh, duh. And like, there's enough of that in the movie that you can kind of catch it, but it's not there. It's not explicit.
Right.
In the book, it's very explicit. Like, this is why they call him the godfather. And aside from the book, I wanted to talk about Fredo.
I love Alfredo.
We didn't talk about this in the first movie. Episode last week, and I was wanting to see if Angela would bring it up, and if so, we'd talk about it, but she didn't, and she said that we'd learn more about Fredo and his reputation in the second movie. Well, we've seen the second movie. I want to talk about an event from 4 years ago, August 13th, 2019, so just shy of 3 years ago. Chris Cuomo Fredo controversy explained. Do you remember this?
Doesn't sound familiar.
All right. So reading from The Cut, linked below. I've not read this article ahead of time. I just did a quick Google for Cuomo Fredo.
If you're on the internet today, you may be wondering who Chris Cuomo is, what he has to do with someone called Fredo, and where your life took a wrong turn. Never fear, I'm going to answer at least two of those questions for you now. One, why was Chris Cuomo mad? On Tuesday, video surfaced of CNN anchor Chris Cuomo. He's no longer with CNN, by the way. He got, I think he was fired during COVID. He also famously got caught COVID and was like, they were doing footage from his basement of like him like talking about dealing with COVID and stuff. And a lot of conspiracies were like, he's not that sick, or he isn't even sick, and blah, blah, blah. His brother was then Governor Anthony Cuomo. So if you think that there might be some perverse incentives when a CNN anchor is brother to the governor of New York, yeah, Jeff, you'd be right. That breeds some controversy. Corruption.
Cuomo.
Video surfaces of CNN anchor Chris Cuomo losing it after some guy, reportedly a Trump supporter, called him Fredo as an insult.
In the footage, Cuomo screams that Fredo is an Italian aspersion. It's an assault to your people. It's like the N-word to us, is what he said. Cuomo, who is of Italian heritage, goes on to say, I'll f***ing ruin your shit. I'll f***ing throw you down these stairs like a f***ing punk.
And how tactful.
Yeah. And how did this meltdown go over? After the clip was first posted on Twitter, Cuomo became the subject of generalized roasting, both from those on the left who found the characterization like the N-word to us offensive and patently ridiculous, and from the Trump family, never one to shy away from a Twitter fight. To this day, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, who maintains a glossary of all potentially offensive words and hand gestures, and will explain, like, not real well, but, you know, somewhat, like, why this is offensive. Like, for example, did you know the number 88 is offensive?
In what context?
It's, in any context, it's a dog whistle of anti-Semitism because 88 references HH because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet, which could only mean Heil Hitler. So if any time you use 88 in any kind of communication, clearly...
Dale Earnhardt Jr. raced in the Mountain Dew 88 race car. So does that mean that he is a white supremacist?
That's what the ADL would say. The reason I bring that up...
I am... That wasn't an antagonist. I do like Dale Earnhardt Jr. though. It'd be cool if he'd be a guest someday. That's the first 88 reference that came up. I just wanted to clarify.
No, I love it.
That was
it.
Not an accusation.
No, it was perfect.
Here's
the thing. It points out though how absurd the ADL is with these things. And even despite them being that silly, they still don't have Fredo in their glossary of offensive terms. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "Hey Chris Cuomo, take it from me, Fredo isn't the N-word for Italians. It just means you're the dumb brother." Big Donnie J said, "I thought Chris was Fredo also. The truth hurts. Totally lost it. Low ratings at CNN." So yeah, Fredo, Chris Cuomo, who was the less impressive of the two brothers, got slurred as Fredo. I want to hear your thoughts, Jeff. Based on what we've seen in The Godfather Part 2, do you think calling somebody Fredo is offensive?
No. No,
like not even is it anti-Italian? Because like that's irrelevant. Do you think would it be offensive to call somebody Fredo?
I don't think you could take it in a way where it's I'm doing this. Oh, hey, Fredo! Like, first of all,
they're calling him the dumb brother,
right? I've called many people. I would say adjacent terms in just ways of like being candid, just being funny. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it goes any further than that. I'm just saying, like, Fredo! Like,
yeah,
like.
I agree.
Like, I think it'd be way worse if you went up to someone and said, like, well, you're being a big old Hitler right now. I think that is way worse than calling someone Fredo from a fictional movie.
Yeah.
I also think granted, there are implications to it, but, like, if someone gets hurt by, like, just stop.
Well, also, the fact that it riled him up so much is just evidence that it's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like, it struck a nerve because he knows he's the less impressive brother.
Yeah.
Which it sucks,
yeah. And yeah, and it's only painful if you spend time
if with you internalize
characters.
It,
yeah, like yeah. It's I think it's petty. I think most name calling is petty.
All right, knucklehead. Oh, all right.
I got a line for you. If that was the end of that thought process,
yeah,
it's a very vague line.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe there's something here to talk about. Maybe not. Maybe it'll be real quick, but. Michael Corleone, my father taught me many things here. He taught me in this room. He taught me, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. This is not the first time we've heard a phrasing of this. Like, and maybe this is the original of where this line comes from, but like, just that specific statement. I see this come up in a lot of other movies, you know, a lot of strategies for things like, you know, is this a respectable way to live your life? Not just strategic, like if you're in a place of power, you know, like I'm not just talking about strategy as far as like just keeping everyone close and in your eyesight, but like, is this a respectable way to live? And again, this could be just super lame as far as the question goes, but just this comes up a lot in different types of scenarios. You know, we're enemies. I'm going to keep you in my pocket. You know, like just this scenario comes up a lot. So what's your thoughts on this phrase?
Yeah, I think if you're in a line of work that requires the level of conspiracy and paranoia that their job does, there's people that want their scalps. I think in that case, yeah, it does make sense. But also, not terribly practical. right?
Because the people closest to you are the one that's going to betray you. So if you're keeping your enemies close.
Right. And oh. isn't there a whole movie called Sleeping with the Enemy, or like,
probably
if it's not called that, it's that whole idea of like,
yeah,
I don't know. I just, it comes up a lot and I'm just like, is there times where it's beneficial to
interestingly save too.
Face? And I mean, you know, we sit here together week after week.
Yeah.
You know, and
cause I don't trust you.
Right.
So and, you gotta, you know, keep my eye on you.
Unbeknownst to your knowledge, you know, I know the schemes you have for me.
Yeah.
Says the Lord. And you know, I just
scheming all day.
I could never enjoy my life if that's the way I strategize my future journey. You know, this idea of like, just keeping that thought in mind of like, yeah, everyone good, everyone cool. Hey, anyone have any beef? Cause we want to make sure those people are like near and dear to our hearts. Cause we want to keep our, like I couldn't live a lifestyle like that. Like that would be a toxic, way of living.
Yeah.
In that mindset of prioritizing enemies over family, imminent enemies, like, and just to add into this conversation, maybe this doesn't connect at all, but I despise your masquerade. So this is Senator Pat Geary talking to Michael Corleone.
Yeah.
So Pat Geary says, I despise your masquerade, the dishonest way to you pose yourself, you and your whole family. Michael goes, we're both part of the same hypocrisy, Senator.
Yeah, I got this lined up.
But never think it applies to my family. Mm-hmm. So like, he's willing to have like, it just like, it's almost, I don't know. Again, they may not connect, but I kind of connected these two just mentalities, just trying to get into the mind of Michael.
Yeah.
Of like keeping your enemies at play and watching them, but also keeping family separate from all of it.
It's explored much better in the book.
And we get it. You've read the book, Nelson.
I listened to the book. I don't read.
And it's explored somewhat in the first movie about this idea of civilians. And civilian casualties are unacceptable. And in the first movie, we see that Michael is a civilian. So he's not going to be at risk of being targeted. Michael chooses to get involved, and that's why he has to go hide in Sicily for 2 years. In the book, they go into greater detail explaining, like, mafia men weren't even worried about the other guys knowing where their family was. It wasn't a concern. In fact, it was expected, yeah, you probably know where my wife and kids are, but they're off limits. They're not involved. This is business. And one of the lines in the book that I really wish had been added into either of the movies is when one of many times that someone says, nothing personal, it's just business. Michael Corleone loses it. And he's like, of course it's personal. It's always personal. We always say that, but it's always personal. All of this is personal. And I think that that's really honest and should have been included in the movies because, yeah, there was this sense that they had of like themselves as thieves with a code, moral criminals. We don't get our family involved. Leave our families out of it.
And they saw themselves as kind of like above the law. And I also had that line written down. Senator, we're both part of the same hypocrisy. But I had it written down for the other point he's making there.
What's that?
Well, the senator says, you know, you're these dirty thieving criminals and hypocrites and blah, blah, blah.
He's trying to make a buck off of them.
Right. And yeah. Michael's like, yeah, we all are. And so I've said this in the past, I don't know if I brought it up last week. There's the quote, the government is the mafia parading as a humanitarian rights organization.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I respect about the mafia compared to the government is that they're honest about who they are. They don't presume to be something that they're not. They know we're criminals. We're flouting your rules. We don't respect your rules. We're going to do it our way. And they're honest about that. And I think it's really easy for us to kind of paint criminals as having no kind of code whatsoever. But the truth of the matter is, especially with the Sicilian mob and different organizations that have different sets of values, but like they're not just agents of chaos.
As they said in the first movie, and they talked about it in this movie as well, you know, violence is expensive.
Yep. And we talked about this by the end of, we kind of summed it up by the end of the Godfather Part One. If you haven't listened to that episode and you're listening to this one first, shame on you.
Yeah. Like we think it's weird enough when you guys listen to the episodes without having seen the movie, but if you're listening to the sequel
movies with out of order.
Yeah. That's just,
yeah.
Unforgivable.
Email us either way.
Yeah.
tell
us why we're wrong.
But this trilogy of movies, and again, you've read the book. We neither of us have seen the third movie yet, but like from what you said, that is the name is the subname of the movie. Like this movie's about Michael.
Yeah.
As much as Don Vito was prominent in the first movie, like this movie's about Michael's journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what we see is him trying to build his stats and sharpen his skills as a mobster. Like, mm-hmm. And another line that I had down was, I'm not sure who he was talking to, but he just puts down, "I don't have to wipe out everybody out, Tom, just my enemies."
Yeah.
It's like, you just see this, not necessarily inconsistency, but just this indecisiveness of what to do with the people around me. Like, mm-hmm. just like, and I kind of got this whole, like, okay, he lived in a gated, like, he lived in fear. We see this whole movie is Michael living in fear. Every decision he makes, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not, but correct me if I'm wrong, he's making his decisions out of fear, which compared to his dad, he was a step ahead. I mean, yeah, there were still risks. Yeah, his son still got murdered, and he still had casualties. But, like, he knew how the other people were playing the game. Michael is trying to play catch up. That's how I perceive it. Even if we do perceive him as ahead the whole time, there's still times where we're like, I don't think he fully gets what's going on. And I just think that's the comparison between Vito and Michael is just Vito has age. You know, he has many years of wisdom. He's been doing this for a lot longer. And you just see he's a lot more calmer about it. Michael gets loose off his cuff a lot quicker, a lot more hot-headed. I just think there's just not inconsistencies, but just this unrhythm of how he handles some situations. And that specifically being the people he has around me. He isolates. He has a gated town that, like, we at least, and granted, the first movie, we see the house, there is a gated entry. We see that at the wedding and stuff, and we see, but, like, the idea of him having a gated entrance and guards, and he didn't let his wife go out and grocery shop with the kids or go away for the weekend or whatever. Like, there's a lot more fear-based decisions about you can't do this, can't do this, can't do this, you can't do this, stay here, like, than I feel we got from Vito. And I just feel like we're seeing him trying to duplicate what Vito was doing and doing it poorly.
I mean, both the first and second movie are us watching one of the Corleones and their families react to that person, like an attempt on that guy's life.
Yeah.
First one was attempt on Vito's life. Second one's attempt on Michael's life.
Correct.
And their reaction to that. We don't get to see a lot of Vito's reaction to it because he's unconscious for a lot of it, right?
Right.
I would say that what we perceive as Michael's fear in this, it's hard to say if that's what it was like before the attempt, because there's really not much in the movie before the attempt on his life. Just that, not a confirmation of his son. I would say, I think he's paranoid. I don't know necessarily fear, but certainly paranoid.
Yeah, okay, I can see that, yeah.
But the first movie is full of paranoia, too.
From Vito or from other people?
From Sonny, Michael, and Hagen.
Okay, yeah.
Vito's unconscious, like I said.
But even the moments he's not unconscious, he seems to have a great grasp of what's going on.
Yeah. And then also we see though in Godfather Part 2, from the way he's always been, he's very calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah. And he stays a step ahead.
Yeah.
He's very much the Grand Admiral Thrawn.
What we see in the book is that the reason he is that way is because he saw what happened to his father, who couldn't control his rage,
right.
And it caused him to get murdered by the Don of the Corleone town.
Right.
And Sonny and Michael both get their rage from Vito. Vito just has the best control over it. But I agree. I think the majority of the movie is him acting out of paranoia.
Yeah,
he's trying to be steps ahead like his father was, but he's not as good about juggling life and... And one of the big differences, and again, I think the book paints this picture better, Vito and all of his influence is because of how good of a job he's done serving his community. Michael and all of his influence is how much fear he can instill. Vito had the olive oil company, which we see in this movie. It wasn't really discussed.
Stripped
the first
it right
one.
Out of Popeye's hands.
And that was legitimate business. They used it for money laundering, but it was legitimate business. Leading up to World War I, it was very profitable. During World War I, it was very difficult to import oil. That's when he turned to crime. During the Great Depression, his men were doing really well. Everybody else was suffering. He got more men because people were like, I want to work for Don Corleone. He's got work. Then he completely legitimizes the oil industry takes off. But then the prohibition happens, and the money's just too good. So he gets into running alcohol. And then it gets completely legitimate again. And then World War II happens and it's hard to get oil. And like it, so it's this constant cycle of, I want to run a clean business.
the money's too good. Well, I don't want to clean business, money's too good. And then we see in this movie, Kay says to Michael, you said to me in 5 years the Corleone family would be completely legitimate. That was 7 years ago. And his response is, I know, I'm trying.
We're as unconvinced as she is that he's trying.
Yeah. And she calls him out on that. I mean, at the end of the movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, she pushes back, which I appreciate of. And,
yeah. Oh, man.
That was a hard scene as well.
That tortured me.
Yeah, that wasn't fun to watch.
Mario Puzo didn't want the abortion in the movie. Francis Ford Coppola, his sister, knew a woman that basically happened for. And like, well, this is what it's based off of. And so they negotiated. This movie is much more based off of, let's put a mafia spin on some of the events happening right now in history. The first movie is almost entirely just things from Mario Puzo's book. And Mario Puzo's book, it's really hard to determine
how much of this is fiction and how much of this is history.
Right.
You know? He's very cagey about his sources.
There's a line. And I can't remember who says this to who and about what. Oh, no. This is, what's the big guy's name? In the first movie, he's the real big dude. Leave the gun, take the cannoli.
I don't remember his name.
And he's one of the, in this movie, he's the one that passes the guns wrapped up to Vito, young Vito. And they're talking about the guy who, you know, the guy in the white suit. And Vito says to him, if he's Italian, then why does he bother other Italians? The guy says, he knows they have nobody to protect them. We talked about this on the waterfront. We talked about this a little bit last week. Historically in America, the way organized crime comes up is you have a community that the official and monopolized use of force is not protecting.
Mm-hmm.
The police are not serving this community. And so they serve themselves.
Historically how it's happened. This guy is
evil, though. He's corrupt. And he sees that these guys have nobody protecting them. And so not, and so I will protect them. It's, and so I will exploit it.
Right.
But on the other hand, and this is something that
I think Lee kind of feeds into why you're uncomfortable with my position on guns, is that the corrective reaction always comes as a result of exploitation. If this community wasn't being exploited, then organized security wouldn't show up because they wouldn't need it.
Right.
Right. But unfortunately, when there's an opportunity to exploit, someone will take that opportunity. And
as ugly as this sounds, that creates a service opportunity for somebody else who's willing to do that dangerous work.
There's a hole. Someone's going to fill it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, yeah.
I have here written in my notes, extortion as taxation and the result of guaranteed employment.
I watched this movie a few days ago, and I can't remember the exact scene that this was in reference to, but I believe I wrote this down in reference to that same guy in the white suit goes to Vito's boss and says, hey, I got this nephew. You need to employ him. Because of that, Vito gets cut.
Because this guy was guaranteed a job, it disrupted the labor force. Now Vito is out of a job. And this happens with government regulation. There's government regulation that guarantees employment or attempts to. And the result is that often the more qualified person gets cut for the less qualified person.
Mm-hmm.
And then extortion as taxation.
You've probably heard me say taxation is theft. You've also heard me say taxation is slavery. Because at the end of the day, somebody with a gun is going to come to you if you don't pay your taxes. And that's the way extortion works. You pay this money or somebody with a gun shows up.
Did you read or hear the line? It's Michael and Hyman talking.
Mm. Hyman Roth.
And I think, not to complete the subject,
no,
I think this goes with what you're saying. Michael's talking to Hyman, and Michael goes, I saw a strange thing today. Some rebels were being arrested.
Mm-hmm.
One of them pulled the pin on a grenade.
Mm-hmm.
He took himself and the captain of the command with him.
Yeah.
Now, soldiers are paid to fight.
Mm-hmm.
The rebels aren't. Hyman goes,
what does that tell you?
What does that tell you? And Michael goes, they could win.
The rebels have been here for 50 years. It's in their blood.
Oh, so you have seen this movie. Okay.
I've heard of it.
Does that line also connect with what you were saying about this idea of just monetizing something, whether regardless of the value it brings to society, no matter what they are monetizing, the fact that you know, the value is the value there for all of it. Like, does that connect with that?
I mean, it sort of does. So the soldiers are paid to fight. The rebels aren't. The rebels are doing it just for the love of the game. They're doing it because they're passionate about it. Now, the truth of the matter is, if the soldiers weren't there, these rebels, who clearly are very passionate about their communities and willing to do violence to protect their communities, they don't just disappear because the soldiers aren't there. In theory, these same types of people would be the ones that would protect the communities. Now, we know history that shortly after Fidel took power, most of the rebels that helped him get it were wiped out so that he could secure his dictatorship. Because that's the way communism typically goes, Jeff, is the people that would put you up against the wall are the first ones up against the wall. And so there is a correlation there of, like,
of the people that are paid to fight, their values are going to be a little different than the people doing it for free.
Right. You see that a lot, like people, and look at me bringing up a sports reference.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, like, that's their argument against, they would rather watch college football over professional football.
Mm-hmm.
Because
stakes are different.
Stakes are different. To some extent, I would agree with that. As someone who doesn't watch either, like, obviously college, they're not getting paid. Some of them may be getting,
they're getting paid in tuition.
They're getting paid in tuition, but, you know, and then they're not supposed to be getting bribes and stuff, but that does happen.
Yep.
You know,
because of the disproportionately black populace of college football, there have been allusions to the fact that the NCAA is basically a slave organization, having these young black men in the prime of their life work for them and taking all the money for it. There's certainly a conversation to be had there.
Yeah. But yeah, I can see that played out in different scenarios of demographics and
mm-hmm. See, I wouldn't say it's a direct correlation with privatized security, but there is something to be said, like, when people are sufficiently fed up with injustice, they're going to fight back.
Yeah. Vigilantes.
Yeah. And I'd be fine with all of justice being vigilante justice.
Mm-hmm. As long as they had cool code names.
Yeah.
You can't just be like, I'm Nelson. And I'm going to beat you up for stealing some kid's lunch money.
Yeah.
That's just lame.
Well, also,
you would be the Nelsonator.
Also, you know, I think something we saw in the first movie, which is, and I don't know how well we see it in the second one, which is that violence ought to be proportional. The young, the man whose daughter was, in the movie she was raped, in the book she was beaten up. And she never gave in.
Really? The book was over-sexualized, but in the book they don't make that a rape.
They don't make it a rape. The boys beat her up, and the reason that they get off on the charge is because, as the judge said, they didn't molest her. They only beat her and hospitalized her. And so when he wants them dead, Vito's like, hey, well, that's not justice. Your daughter's still alive. And he's like, okay, well, then just put them in the same condition that they put my daughter in.
Right.
So that's justice in a sense.
Justice.
You know, there's an interesting conversation there because Vito says, well, actually, you've already got your justice. You trusted the courts, you trusted the police, and that's the justice you get from them. And the man says, well, the boys got justice, but my daughter hasn't got justice. I haven't got justice.
A lot of the book explores this idea of the legitimacy of institutional power and what truly is justice. And this movie has some of that. I think it's... Okay, so one thing I thought was really interesting in this movie, one of several, Clemenza is trying to see how much Vito knows about crime. And Vito's response is, I'm not interested in things that don't concern me. Kind of moment is like, oh, this is like a real, like, aloof guy who knows just what to say. But really, when you think about that line,
he's really just stating the obvious. And, you know, coming back to our conversation that we opened the episode with, most people are not interested in things that don't concern them. That's why most people don't know who their state representative is. Most people don't know who the prime minister of Greenland is because it doesn't concern you. It's not going to come up in your day to day.
Right. Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I agree.
What do you think of the line? So Kay wants to leave and Michael's not allowing her to. And Kay says, am I a prisoner? Hagen says, that's not the way we look at it, Kay. What do you think of that? It's very like new speak. Eurasia has always been at war.
You could use that quote out of context for, you know, that whole idea of like, you know, we see walls around America, you see prison. Any sort of argument like that, like you see fences, we see protection, stuff like that. But in specifically in the movie, like for it being something that's just business, you know, especially how Vito ran it, what he did was just business. And for the most part, he tried to keep family out of it. the way that that rule existed and the way that she can't do anything, like, it really shows that it was, it's more than just business. It is family. It is
personal.
It's personal. It's everything that we're doing. It's every,
it's aspect. Our life. It's our whole right. life.
And it just builds up on the fact that, you know, when we met her first in movie one, you know, he's like, it's my father's business. I don't seek to be a part of it. Like, then you hear that go on later. Like, you know, you said it was going to be, what was it? Something in 5 years.
It's going to be 5 years and it's been seven.
Right. It's been seven. Just like you're seeing, just build on that idea of like, he's not a man of his word, yeah. even to his wife.
Yeah.
And she is living, well, the movie, she is living in a prison, whether it's a physically.
Part one ends with him lying to her, bold-faced.
Yeah. Whether it's actually a physically gated building she's prisoned in, or just this marriage,
yeah.
this relationship, this structure that they have, is whether she could leave or not, it's, you know, she still would be imprisoned in this idea of like, she's drastically affected by everything he does that he's saying is not affecting her.
Right. It's Hagen's response. That's not the way we look at it, Kay.
Mm-hmm.
She is a prisoner.
Yeah.
She's not allowed to leave.
They vaguely threaten what might happen if she did leave. She's a prisoner. But that's not the way we look at it, Kay.
A little bit of gaslighting there.
It's
right.
It's, like it is gaslighting. It's also something that we see a lot with government officials.
For example, in the U.S., the only way that you can constitutionally have a war is an act of Congress.
And so when somebody says it's an illegal war, they would say something like, well, that's not the way we look at it. This is a military action.
Hmm.
That's not the way we look at it. It's just surveillance. That's not the way we look at it. It's just
a health emergency. It's just whatever.
Right.
It is gaslighting. You're right. But it's also, you've read 1984?
I have not. I was born in 89.
Okay. So in the book 1984, written in 1948,
there is this concept of newspeak, where the government is regularly editing and updating approved words. And they've completely rewritten the dictionary to be simpler, they say. So, for example, something isn't bad, it's ungood.
And it might be very bad. So instead of saying very, because that's kind of lazy, you'd say double ungood. But maybe it's really, really bad, but you wouldn't say really, really, because that's, you know, lazy. So it's double plus ungood.
Oh my gosh.
And they just have like they change the
how language. How did that not catch on?
They change the language. And that's a pedantic way and silly way they change the language. But then they also have like slogans like war is peace.
So they
completely changed what the thing means. Am I a prisoner? That's not the way we look at it.
Yeah.
So it is gaslighting, but it's also, you know, thought control. It's
language. It's politician talk.
Yeah. 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 And he is a lawyer.
You know, like, and you can take that in the pro-life argument, like, a lot of people that are pro-life.
Just a fetus.
But, oh, but then it's also the same people that are like, well, the death penalty is different.
Yeah.
You know, like so there's people that are pro-life, not necessarily pro-life in every aspect, and vice versa. You know, like it the coin is two sides.
Yeah.
Like, so
when it comes to the death penalty,
the Old Testament instructs it. And so I support it. I just don't trust our government to execute it the way that the Bible instructs it, because they haven't ever. So I'm against our government doing the death penalty, until which time they do it exactly as instructed in the Bible.
That's where I land on death penalty.
Okay. Okay. I'm aloof to get into a heated debate with you today.
Yeah. That's cool. I thought this was really brilliant
directorial choice.
Hyman Roth is meeting with a bunch of businessmen, including Michael Corleone, and he's talking about how he's going to apportion his various interests to his friends while he's still alive. Remember this?
Yes.
And while he's talking about how he's going to carve up his business interests in Cuba for his friends, he's literally cutting up his birthday cake, which has got a picture of Cuba on it. So he's carving up Cuba for his friends while he's carving up Cuba for his friends.
I didn't pick up on that. I remember that scene.
I thought that was really brilliant directorial choice. No way that that's incidental.
Oh, no.
In Godfather Part 2, they talk a bit about their business dealings during Prohibition, the way that Hyman Roth knew Vito Corleone. Vito Corleone used to drive bus truck for him during the Prohibition era. They would run molasses up to Canada.
bit of history for you. Have you ever heard of Newfie Screech or Newfoundland Screech?
No. Screech from Saved by the Bell. The one that became a porn star.
And then lost a bunch of weight. Good
and then
him.
And then died.
Of cocaine.
Yeah, he died.
So
Dustin Diamond.
Yeah, what a name. Newfoundland Screech during the Prohibition. A porn
star name.
Yeah.
Like, he definitely set himself up for that.
His parents did.
Right.
He didn't name himself.
No. Anyways, go on.
I don't know that for a fact. He might have, like Michael.
It could have been a stage name from the very beginning as a child actor.
Yeah.
I don't know that either, but Dustin Diamond was his name on Saved by the Bell.
Yeah.
As well as into his adult age. Yeah. And he did adult films. And then died.
$20 is $20. So Newfoundland Screech is rum sold in Newfoundland with roughly 40% alcohol by volume. And the term screech is a colloquial term that has been used to describe almost any cheap, high alcohol spirit, including moonshine. The term is used in the brand name for this mid-priced rum to associate the brand with this tradition. Now, the tradition comes from, during the Prohibition, they would ship molasses, which is an extract from sugar cane, up to Canada to turn into rum to bring back to the States, sailing it in and bringing it into the docks in New York. Now, it wasn't very good because they don't, like, rum is not really a traditional Scotch-Irish drink. So the Scotch-Irish in Newfoundland were doing the best they could, but they're making a liquor that's not really their liquor. And so Screech is real bad rum. Terrible, terrible, terrible stuff.
You've had it? Do they still make, like, a version of it today?
So Screech is a brand now, but it used to be just this term for this hooch that they were
making. I'd be curious to try, like, an authentic recipe of that.
Well, let's talk a little bit then. Let's take a diversion to talk about a Screech Inn. So Newfoundland Screech is used in a ceremony known as the Screech Inn. The Screech Inn is a ceremony performed on non-Newfoundlanders, known to Newfoundlanders as a come-from-away or mainlander, involving a shot of Screech, a short recitation, and the kissing of a cod, a fish. It is often performed either in homes or more commonly in town pubs, such as those on George Street, St. John's. Notable for their Screech-in traditions are Trapper John's, O'Reilly's Irish Newfoundland Pub, and Christian's Bar. So, yeah, if we're ever in Newfoundland, have some Newfies Screech us in.
If we do a series, it's on location, you know? That'd be great.
We want to know something interesting.
Is Newfoundland the part of Canada you're from? Like, is that East Coast?
Further east.
Further east. Okay, so it's not the complete other side, though.
Okay.
A couple lines here for you. Michael pleading with Kay to stay. I'll do everything in my power to keep you from leaving me. Usually when this line is said in a movie, it is a plead. But when he says it, it's a threat.
Right. Yeah.
I thought that was weird. That was interesting.
It was. What does he have to gain from her? Like if he's not invested into his marriage, like, why is he so interested in her sticking around? I mean, granted, the kids, the legacy, but, like, she's not a part of that anymore. Like, as callous as that sounds, like, he's got his son.
He, like, can't afford to be disrespected that way. That's
all it is. So rather take her out than be disrespected.
Or, you know, imprison her in her own home.
Yeah.
If anything in this life is certain, if history has taught us anything, it's that you can kill anyone.
Yep.
Or, as they said in the movie Predator, if it bleeds.
Is that the line? If it bleeds?
We can kill it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's we can or you can.
Okay. Well, you know, pronouns are all loose these days.
Yeah.
She, he, they, I can, you know, it's whatever they choose.
So here's my last one. Or, I don't know. Sorry. Do you have anything to say on that?
No, I don't. It's a morbid.
Nobody's untouchable.
Yeah, no, it's no one's untouchable. Just some, it may take a little bit more footwork and groundwork and teamwork to achieve that morbid outcome. But
yeah. All right.
And in that case, like, it just, you know, like, people's is money, you know, people's is business,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's
really, he's just a really competent and forceful HR coordinator.
Yeah. Yeah. For humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the Northeast sector and then Nevada sector of humans.
No, he's all out of Northeast by the point.
That's true. You're talking specifically of Michael. Yeah. Yeah. So just Nevada and a little. Yeah.
And then continued interests in Cuba.
Cuba.
Here's my last thing from the movie. We touched on it earlier and talked about how it was a difficult scene.
It's wrong to hit a woman.
Oh.
But is it wrong to hit a woman that killed your child?
Yes.
Because we see her say...
What is hitting her going to solve? Like, what do you get by hitting her, whether she dropped eggs on the floor or aborted?
But this was a fertilized egg.
I didn't mean to use... It was not intentional. I don't know if that's too on the nose. I'm not trying to be crass.
Yeah.
Jeff
over here with the abortion jokes. Like, jeez.
What does that do? I'm not a violent person. Like, my first reaction with anything is not to just strike the person. Like, what will that solve? So, is it wrong? Yeah, because there's no, like, that doesn't solve the issue. Having to defend the side of it's right would mean that would solve something. Like, hitting her would then achieve a different outcome. No? Like, no. There's nothing about that's right.
And this fundamentally comes back to our pacifism.
Does it?
Yeah, it really does.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. Sorry.
Because while I personally don't condone retributive violence, I understand it. And I think it's the only form of violence that's legitimate and just.
What does it solve?
It doesn't solve anything.
So why is it just then?
Because
what do you gain from it?
Well,
do you feel better by hitting someone?
Let me ask you this.
Like, rhetorically,
Let me ask you this. Do you believe that God's word is infallible?
Yes.
Okay. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Now.
That's not every scenario.
No, and Jesus specifically calls us to a higher standard than this.
Yes.
But that's the legal standard. Right. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. That's the legal standard established by God through the Mosaic covenant. And so I am sympathetic to attributive violence and think that is the only just form of violence. Personally, I don't think it solves anything, and there are better options, and that's what Jesus calls us to. But it's kind of like the gun ownership thing. I can condone something without partaking in it.
This doesn't even come down to female or male for me. It's just, where do you draw the line? Because, like, going on the spiritual side of things here real quick, like, my sin of lust, my sin of envy, my sin of anger, God sees it as equal as other people who have murdered, fornicated, and stole. Even though I've never murdered someone, stole anything in my adult life that, you know, of value or done any of that stuff. Like I'm guilty of it because I've thought those thoughts. There's no value in retribution. Even if it's allowed, that doesn't mean it's good. Jesus allows people to go to hell because they have the choice to choose him or not choose. That doesn't mean like it's the best thing out there. That doesn't mean people can benefit. Just, I had the choice not to, so I'm not going to. Okay, well, there's negative effects then. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
No, I entirely agree.
Right, and I'm not accusing you of wanting this to happen. But, like, but just to answer your question, there is never a reason. I'm thinking of all the reasons in my head right now. There's never a reason where you're going to where you're going to benefit from hitting someone because they've done wrong to you. You're still going to have that hurt and pain after you strike them. You're going to be the same person after the act of violence is done. Revenge doesn't solve anything.
Yeah, and as I've said before,
quoting from the Tuttle Twins, the way towards peace is for blowback deceased. And what we saw in this movie... I guess it was the last movie. It was in Godfather 1, while Michael Corleone is in Sicily, all of the young men are dead because of vendettas.
Yeah.
When a certain action is justified, choosing not to take that action is showing mercy.
Right. Are you and I in the business of justification? We don't have that ability.
Hold on.
I know. I'm just saying, like, you use the word justify, but, like, you and I can't justify things. We're not called to. There's only one judge.
No, I mean, like,
that justifies. Like, well, it's like we're not called to be the judge, jury.
If we had if we lived under Mosaic law right now, which we don't, but if we did,
right?
If you caused me an injury, intentionally or not, that caused my eye to come out, I would be legally within my rights to remove your eye.
Okay.
I would be justified in doing that. It would be showing mercy to you to say,
even though I have the right to do this, I choose not to do this harm to you.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is there are situations where violence is justified, and it's only in defense or reaction to the initiation of violence. Initiating violence is always unjustified, but responding to violence is justified. That said, I still think, except for in extraordinary circumstances, there are options that don't require attributive violence to resolve the situation.
Looking at the justification thing.
Not whether or not...
Should he have chosen mercy, but was he justified to strike the person responsible for the death of his child, who did it intentionally?
Do you think that was a... Not whether it was a wise thing, do you think it was a justified thing?
I don't know. Like,
it's like, something I struggle with. Like, I'm not sure.
Like, I don't... Because, like, I don't care if it was or wasn't. He shouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
So, to me, the justification doesn't matter. Because, like, it doesn't solve anything. Like, it just shows that you can't control your anger and, like, you can't... Like, you're going to lash out on someone just, like, in that... And you're impulsive. Like, it just, like...
But he's lashing out at the person responsible for the thing he's angry about. He's not just...
Right. No, and I get that.
He's like, not just wanton violence.
And it's a situation that you would you would be very emotional.
Wonton soup.
I could do some violence to some wonton soup. Nah. We're getting into this topic again where, like, I'm more reacting off of my emotions. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to phrase things where I'm not going to say things that are going to be eaten up.
It's weird because for a long time, my opinion on men striking women is that, no, you don't do it. There's some places where the law is if she hits you three times, you can hit her back once. I'm like, okay, whatever. If that's the law, that's the law. I still don't think men hit women.
Does that include spanking? I'm asking for a friend.
If it's consensual.
You can edit that out.
But my point is, men are to be protectors, not issuing violence. But in this situation, I find myself being very sympathetic to his actions here. Only because what she did was totally unjustified.
All of her feelings, as a response to the way he's been behaving, entirely justified. He has been a terrible husband and father.
Yeah.
But her murdering their son so that she doesn't bring another Corleone boy into the world.
That's something that, like...
No, and I agree. Like, I would have come up with, like, seven different other options that she could do.
Abortion arguments aside, like, you might argue, well, it's just a clump of cells. It's clear from the conversation she doesn't think that.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. There was never a is it, isn't it mm-hmm. conversation. It was. Mm-hmm.
Conversation does happen in the book.
Yeah. That's an emotional answer for me.
Yeah.
My non-emotional logical brain goes, what do you benefit from it? Whether it's justified or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be. So my answer to you is maybe.
Yeah. It's.
I. You don't want to take my opinion as the right answer or the wrong answer. But, like, maybe it is. But again, should you? And what do you, like, what do you gain from it? You're going to feel crummy. Like, just.
So I looked up the meaning of the word, and that's interesting.
Crummy?
No. Oh. Cathartic.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes violence, justified violence, is cathartic. It satisfies an inner yearning for
justice. I saw that documentary.
Inner yearning?
Yeah.
It's not a documentary, Jeff.
Oh.
I think that retributive violence, I think that slap was cathartic. It didn't solve anything except it met an emotional need he had in that moment. Now, interestingly, I looked at the word catharsis because that's where cathartic comes from. It's ancient Greek meaning purification or cleansing. And I've only ever heard something being cathartic in the sense of it didn't solve anything, but I feel better about it now. And so I think that that's what this situation is. It's a cathartic.
And that may very well be. It may feel good to knock someone around that wronged you in the moment. But long term, does that catharsis last when now you're dealing with the ramifications of not only their action, but your action?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is something to say about momentary feeling about doing something. You know, even if it's giving into a temptation of, like, smoking or drinking or, you know, a one night stand or something like that. Like, yeah, there's definitely positive feelings and optimistic opportunities that can come from that momentarily. But long term, then, even if that was justified long term, you may now be dealing with the ramifications of something that wasn't, that could have been avoided. Because even though it was justified, doesn't mean it was right.
Yeah.
So
cathartic has the context of a bad behavior that makes you feel good. Right. And it's a fleeting
feeling. Oh, so cathartic is directly tied to a bad behavior.
Every time I've heard it.
Interesting.
But I might be wrong.
Things that are cathartic, they don't solve anything. They just kind of scratch an itch that you feel like there's a wrong that needs to be made right. But it's also
a noun. A cathartic, to use the noun, is a medicine that causes the bowels to be purged.
Hmm.
So.
Write that down for me, Nelson.
It's a powerful diuretic. Also, another powerful diuretic, strawberry leaves brewed into tea.
Okay.
So let's get into wrap-up questions.
The more you know.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Here we go. Would you recommend this film?
If you liked the first film, I'd recommend you go read the book and then watch this film to see how they handled things.
Yeah.
But I would, I kind of recommend the best parts of this movie are when you learn more about Vito Corleone.
And this movie could have been condensed too. Like it's 3.5 hours long. Like I think it would have been more riveting too, if it was a little bit more expressed. So I think that for me, that was a part of like, the enjoyment factor was like, all right, let's keep going. Come on, let's just keep going. Because this one's longer than the first one and longer than the second one. Like,
cost them twice as much to make.
So yeah, I would recommend it. I think it does continue the story of the Corleone family. And I think it's an entertaining watch. Yeah, if you've watched the first one, yeah, I would recommend. Because I would definitely recommend the first one.
Yeah.
To a responsible, mature viewer. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to watch that, I would say, yeah, complete it with at least the second one. Now, we haven't seen the third one yet, so maybe we'll just be like, stop with two. But
and you'll never hear our opinion on the third one, because that's not covered in this podcast.
Nope. Never.
Top 250 only.
Only.
Unless
inclusively.
Unless it's been a short period of time and you no longer are on there.
Yeah.
But we thought it was worth covering anyway.
Right. Yeah. Like we've covered all of our bases.
Everything, everywhere, all at once.
Yeah.
We're men of principle.
Would you change the ratings? Rated R?
No.
No.
I mean, I'd leave it R.
It's the violence is mild as far as like the gore factor, but there are executions. There are
strong language.
Strong language. If I'm not mistaken, there is child nudity, like baby nudity.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Infant nudity.
Yeah.
And then there was also the scene of the sex club when they left the building. I didn't rewind to go watch to make sure, but I'm pretty sure there's some phallic things that are in the background as people are running out of that building.
I missed it.
So I could be wrong on that, but like it caught my eye.
Yeah. Tying back to the opening of our show, logical fallacies. Yeah. I mean, fallacies.
There's the title, I think.
Logical fallacies. Logical fallacies. Nah, I don't think so. Nah.
but yeah, no, there's not any nudity that's direct and in your face.
Yeah.
But there is some sexualizations.
Was there in the first?
Oh, yeah. There was.
Bare breast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two of them.
The pair.
The pair, yeah. Okay, so has it aged well? 1974.
Not as good as the first one.
Mm-hmm. I would say cinematography wise, it's equal. Cinematography.
There's a definition for you.
It's equal. Viewing of, it felt a lot more dated than the first one did. No, okay, I won't say a lot more dated. It was more noticeable. But I still enjoyed it. And would this be in your personal top 250, which you already answered?
Nah, yeah, it would not be.
If it is, it's closer to the bottom, but I would say this one will probably get edged out as I continue to build my list. Once I hit 250 movies, I'll do a whole episode on going which ones did not make it in my 250.
So. Yeah, on Letterboxd, I haven't reached 250 movies reviewed yet. Let me double check.
As he's checking, my list that I'm creating, I'm specifically making the list of movies that we've done with Silver Screen Biases. So it's going to take me a while to build it, but you know, obviously every movie we add gives me a bigger glimpse of like what's in the bottom half, what's in the top half.
As of the time of recording on Letterboxd, I have 223 movies rated. And then
all watched within the last week.
Yeah. All watched within the last year, but there's some that I've watched within the last year that are missing just because I didn't know when I watched them. But 223. I haven't even, I don't know that I could give you, I could even name 250 off the top of my head. I'd we'll probably miss half of
these. We'll get there.
Yeah, it's coming.
So
there will be a day. Do you have any interest in seeing this movie remade?
I like your idea, and I'd be it's low on my list right now, but I'm always open for book suggestions, and I don't read fast enough to get through that list quickly. But I'd be interested to hear your idea of it being that first book or the eight books within the one book. I'd be interested in that being a mini series. Yeah. I would watch that. Let this stand alone. Mm-hmm. And do like a TV mini series, or maybe make it two seasons or something. Tell it in a different way. I'd be interested in that,
especially with one of the greatest things about streaming television rather than appointment television like we used to have is that episodes can be as long as they need to be.
Yeah,
and series can be as long as they need.
You see that like Ahsoka, like last night's episode was 52 minutes, but some of them have been like 30. So like they're using the length that they need, no more, no less.
That's right. So you could take the eight books of The Godfather and make each one its own episode.
Yeah.
And episodes would vary in length quite a lot based on the
story. Stranger Things did that. Like Stranger Things had an hour and a half episode. Yeah. You could easily have many movies within it.
Yeah. And so I think that's a real success of that format.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's next week?
Next week is Rear Window, Alfred Hitchcock.
We're being
Grace Kelly.
Grace Kelly. I don't know if I know.
First Grace Kelly. I only know her because of the song I Want to Be Like Grace Kelly. Ooh. I don't know who sings it, but I know her from a line in a song.
I couldn't pick her out in the lineup. I have no idea what she looks like. In fact, if you told me that Grace Kelly was actually the name of a man, I would not be able to.
I'd be like, oh, that's surprising, but I couldn't prove you wrong. And who's joining us for Grace Kelly? I mean, for Rear Window.
Grace Kelly is.
No way.
From On the Other Side of the Grave. Yes.
I wonder if Cassie's Grace Kelly voice is any good.
Oh, that's right. Cassie, not Grace.
Cassie.
Is coming back.
That's right.
We had a great conversation with her earlier in this series with a Hayao Miyazaki film.
That's right.
And she's back.
And she's a big Alfred Hitchcock fan. Yeah.
And she's a new mother now. So we'll see how life's changed for her since the last time we've talked, and if any of that's come through in her silver screen viewings.
Yeah. So our first ever movie that we covered was Psycho, a Hitchcock movie. Next week will be 1 year from when we started, and so we're launching the second year with another Hitchcock.
I'm just getting emotional here, Nelson.
Yeah, it's our first anniversary, Jeff. Happy anniversary.
Is it the wood anniversary?
I think that's paper. Let me double check.
Paper? I'll get you a certificate.
This will be our first anniversary. That is a paper anniversary.
A paper product.
But the modern gift is a clock.
Oh. So I'll clock you. And it'll be justified. Callback. You wouldn't get that unless you listen to this whole episode. If you, the listener, are just listening to the last 5 minutes of every episode, shame on you. Shame on you.
All right. Is that it for us?
That's it.
Love you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you have found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we would love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high-quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.